Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. On today's episode, we will be asking John Rady about wellness. I hate the movie Beauty and the Beast, a fact that infuriated my daughter Adina when she was younger. My main objection is that it glorifies the myth that young women can fix abusive boyfriends if they just love them enough. But there are a lot of little things in it that annoy me too. This is why, years ago, I find myself complaining to my then 7-year-old daughter about Belle's name meeting Beauty, about the bookstore scene and her love of reading, and a host of details I don't remember. That's when she turned to me and said, "But Dad, pretty isn't the opposite of smart." And with that, I lost yet another of the many arguments I've had with her since she could speak. Adina was right. Beauty is not the opposite of smart, but we sure treat it like it is. We regard a pretty face as a sign of vapidity and a good body as an indication of obliviousness. We do the same with muscles. From Archie comic books Moose to Crab and Goyle in the Harry Potter series, we routinely think of people as zero-sum creatures. You can have a good body or a good brain, but not both. This is why sitcoms joke that a good personality is code for ugly, and why Smart Hulk seems smaller in Endgame than Dumb Hulk was in the first Avengers movie. This is the legacy of mind-body dualism. From its inception, Christianity taught the world that the body is a vehicle for sin, but the soul is a key to redemption. Sexual desire, finding pleasure in food, even physical rest are gateways to the 7 deadly sins. But faith, prayer, and mental discipline, these are the divine aspects of any individual. 1,600 years later, René Descartes came along, making the beginning of the so-called modern world. He argued not only that the soul was made up of different stuff than the body, but that the mind was as well. He described a dualism of mental substance versus physical substance. He argued that the mind brought us certainty and reason, but the body deceived and enslaved us. The mind gave us access to God, while our physical selves made us unable to tell the difference between reality and dreams. This is why we're supposed to love people for their minds, not their bodies. The mind is supposed to be the real person, eternal and unchanging, while the body degenerates, gets old, and is temporary. Our bodies are an illusion, hiding our true selves, which is why audiences can feel superior to Gaston in Beauty and the Beast. We love Belle for her intellect, not her looks. It's also why so many people speak about Chris Hemsworth with awe. How can the guy who plays Thor be beautiful, physically perfect, and also smart, funny, and the nicest guy in the world? If you read about him online, you'll see the same comment over and over again. "It's not fair," they say. Somehow, Hemsworth's existence seems immoral or unjust. There is one area, however, where this is reversed: medicine. Over the last 50 years, the mental discipline that society had glorified for so long has become eclipsed by psychoactive drugs. Instead of depression being described as it had been for so long, a character weakness, it is now treated as a chemical imbalance with pills. Social anxiety, addiction, hyperactivity, these were all once condescendingly regarded as shortcomings of the will. They are now pathologized, regarded as the malfunctionings of a broken machine. Now, to be clear, I'm not suggesting that depression or other disorders are not illnesses, nor am I bad-mouthing medications. I, like many of my listeners, have benefited immensely from antidepressants. What I'm pointing out is that the mind used to be regarded as the controlling force of the body, but now modern medicine is in control. We have flipped our commitment, prioritizing brain over mind, neurochemicals over attitude. Yet we're still attached to the original dualism, glorifying one or the others, but not both. This is where today's discussion comes in. On this episode, we're going to consider a more holistic approach to health and wellness. We're going to look at the way our physical and mental behaviors work together to improve both at the same time. We will cultivate their relationship instead of regarding them as competition. This marks a radical shift from the last 500 years because it recognizes the mind and body as equally important. In fact, what it really tells us is that the mind is the body and vice versa. The relationship is more like convex and concave sides of a spoon than an object in its shadow. The true legacy of Beauty and the Beast, then, is its incoherence, not the moral I detest so much. To disregard Belle's beauty is just as two-dimensional as ignoring her mind. To forgive Beast's violence so easily is equally unfair. We are all whole people. We are our actions, our attitudes, our intellects, our physical selves, and our abstract identities. Any story that treats us like unconnected pieces is bound to be unsatisfying. We need more than a fairy tale to teach us about wellness. And now our guest. Best-selling author John J. Rady is an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He's the author of Spark, The Revolutionary New Science of Exercise in the Brain, and most recently, Go Wild, which explores how the prehistoric roots of physical and mental health. John, welcome to Why.
I'm glad to be with you. Glad to be talking about philosophy a bit as well.
If you'd like to comment on the show, you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, all as at Why Radio Show, all one word, or email us at askwhy@und.edu. You can find all of our episodes for free and information about future episodes at whyradioshow.org. So, John, I've been using the term wellness to describe on our ads and in the monologue what we're talking about, because I don't think health really captures the holistic nature of what you're doing. Do the terms wellness and health really mean different things, or am I just being a philosopher over focusing on words?
Well, I do think wellness is the gateway to health and well-being. And I think that's what's changing today in medicine, what's changing today in our understanding of what we need to be doing to make our lives the best that they can be. The hot areas today especially are trying to prevent Alzheimer's disease, and wellness is the ticket. All the drugs now are not so important, or many of them have come and gone, and there is no magic pill to help preserve our brains. But being well in every which way is the tool to keep us keep us young and our brains young. So from that angle, it's really about delivering the kind of health that we want to have.
Is this a new direction for medicine in particular? I mean, some of the histories you tell in your two books, you suggest or directly relate to tensions between scientists and psychiatrists. You even at one point say that psychiatrists were resistant to exercise because as intellectuals, they didn't particularly like it all of that much. How new is this approach, and how hard was it to get people to shift their ideas?
Well, it works in every domain, in with the teachers, with the doctors, with the scientists. They all have a problem with seeing wellness and in Spark's case, seeing exercise as a ticket to ride, as a way into improving test scores for the teachers, for instance, as well as the child's wellness overall. And for the psychiatrists, it was a big leap because, don't forget, we've only had the magic drugs since the 60s, 50s and 60s, really, and that was a big revolution. And then to find that, oh, well, what about exercises treating the depression or treating the anxiety or treating the attention deficit disorder? It becomes a problem because we finally have something in terms of what we can do for the mind and the mind brain, and then you're saying, oh no, all you have to do is live right, unfortunately the answer is you can do both, but you certainly, if you're living right, if you're following the dictates of our genes essentially, you will be able to avoid getting depressed, decrease the amount of time you're anxious or stressed. So those are huge changes, and I think medicine has had a horribly hard time in shifting their view back to that which our grandmothers told us. You know, go outside, play all day, get enough sleep, and make sure you have a lot of friends. So those are the tickets.
In a little while, we'll talk about those particular, I'll call them prescriptions, but you did something very interesting in your answer. You said mind, and then you caught yourself and you said mind-brain. Why did you do that, and what's the difference between those two terms?
What's the difference? That's a philosophical question.
Well, that's what's
the
we're
difference?
Here for.
is the brain is the meat. And the mind sort of is the final product of all the clicking and clacking of our electricity and neurochemicals in our brains. So they're the same, but the mind is produced by the brain. And this is always the conundrum that people have been stuck on since Descartes, really. Whom you mentioned, you know, I mean, the ghost in the machine. And so we've separated it. And, you know, before that it was a soul, and then it was the self and the mind. And now we're zeroing in on, okay, this is the self working in the brain. We think we can actually see this happening or see maybe even localize it, which is not easy to do, but we hold on to those images and those words of the past as we're unpacking what our amazing brains do.
I understand that as philosophers, we get a sort of analytic advantage to distinguishing between the mind and the brain, either for epistemology when we're studying knowledge, or metaphysics when we're studying sort of reality and whether souls exist and things like that. But do you think that medicine and psychiatry is benefited by dividing the two, or would we better off using a term like mind-brain to remind ourselves of the intimate connection? Is there the same analytic advantage in separating them, or should we reconceive of the two parts as a whole?
Well, I think today, in today's world, that the problem is that we're not focusing enough on mind. We're focusing much more on brain. And I think there is an advantage of separating them. You know, and just what you brought up about the pharmacology, you know, that's brain stuff. But there's a powerful lot of the mind that's involved. You know, the good treatment in general for people is cognitive behavioral training. Well, that's all about changing your mind and holding on to the mind, and each morning having a positive growth mindset. That's a big push these days, to have a positive growth mindset. In other words, look for the positive, think it's going to be positive, and you're going to grow, and you're going to grow whatever you're doing. That's what Carolyn Zweck at Stanford has sort of made part of our language. And so it's a mindset. It's not a brain set, but the brain develops the mind. And you have to screw around with the brain with drugs and with other wellness actions that make the brain work better, and thus the mind is clearer or more directed. So I do think we have an advantage of separating them. But then everybody gets confused and worried. You know, I grew up in psychiatry as wanting to be a psychoanalyst. I've been in psychoanalysis myself more than Woody Allen. So, but it didn't work. So, I mean, you know, anyway.
Didn't work for him either.
my brain was too quick. And then I discovered attention deficit disorder and realized that was part of my life too. And that made me not a very good person on the couch, patient, subject. But we, when I grew up, this was all about the mind, right? It was all about changing the self understanding, and the mind would switch. And we know that the brain changes when that happens, when you do good psychotherapy or when you do, you know, relieve the pressure of a trauma or of a fear. The mind changes and the brain changes, and we know that. We know that. We see that on our fancy scans. We can see that happen. And so we know they're so interactive that and really, but the dualism helps, for instance, in saying, okay, but you really have to work at it to establish this mindset, this positive growth mindset, or this positivity, and block out the negativity, and that will have a big effect on your brain and then on your lives. So, and that's more what you see today, what people are finding today, that this is, we need to think of them as both.
Has psychology changed its definition of agency? Has the role of the patient as the primary mover in health and wellness, has that shifted over the last few decades? Your first book, Driven to Distraction, which was immensely important in the discussion of attention deficit disorder, was that ADD and ADHD, especially for kids, is sort of been the cultural example for passiveness. Give a kid a pill so it's almost always he will be quiet in class. Give a kid a pill so he can focus and stop being a nuisance. And at the same time, well, that's just an example of parents being lazy or not caring about the kid enough, and all this sort of cultural drama that's really about politics more than anything else. Has psychiatry changed its definition of agency and how important the patient is? And how did the ADD discussion map that out?
Well, I think it's a mistake to just look at the brain as being the agent. And ADD is a good example. Yes, Ritalin or Dexedrine, they can really make a change in many people. But there's all these other parts of the patient that are necessary to have them deal with. And that's where the agency comes in. You can make people feel better. But then they have to change, or most of the time, have to alter their choices in their lives, of what they do and how they do it and how they accomplish things. And they need to learn that, how to best actualize themselves. And that's where the agent comes from. Now, medicine or these wellness tools, they all make the brain and then the mind better. And so you're providing the better scaffolding, if you will, for where the mind sits and how it functions. So if you're gloomy and depressed and you haven't taken an antidepressant, you feel less depressed. But then you have to go do. And the go do comes from choices and directions initiated by the totality of your mind and yourself, and all those words get really fuzzy. But if you're too depressed, your self is obliterated, and all you are in is a do loop, thinking about how horrible life is. The classic, very depressed patient. And then with ADD, I mean, and that was a big move, because all of a sudden people said, "Whoa, I can pay attention. I can have my mind go where I want it to go and stay with it." But still, one has to make choices and learn how to structure your life so that you have the best opportunity to succeed in every which way. So it's not just changing the meat, if you will. You have to then have the instruction book on how to maximize your life, having had this problem or having this problem that may be helped by the medicine. But, you know, you still need to do something about it. Now, with specifically to your question about how the ADD maps it out, I mean, it became a big deal to search for the genes, right? When we began to identify the genes, everybody wanted to find the ADD gene. Well, unfortunately, there's about 60 of them. There are 60 gene mistakes that are associated with ADHD and ADD, and none of them hold up for all the kids and all the adults that have attention problems. And so we see it today as a big spectrum, like so many things that we have. In terms of diagnoses, there are spectrums, and it usually doesn't depend on what genes you have. It's a combination of so many things, just as it is for autism and even for depression, although some people with depression can have genetic problems, and that can lead to better choices for treatment. But, you know, there's just so much there that we need to really pay attention to. It's not just, okay, your attention works, but now, and a big thing happens is, okay, but I still have to prioritize my day or my life and say what's really important. That doesn't all come to you, and it makes your attention better to stay with things, but you have to begin them, and that's a challenge often for people to prioritize.
When we come back, I want to pull some of these threads. I want to talk about the particular conclusions you come to. I also want to talk about this idea that depression obliterates the self. I thought that's incredibly fascinating, and the way that all of this stuff helps either refine or distort the mirror in which we see ourselves, not just the way that other people see us. But before that, we're going to take a break. You're listening to John Rady and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. I'm talking with John Rady about wellness. I just got back from a month-long fellowship in Indianapolis at a private political philosophy institute. And I was spending 6-7 hours a day writing at a desk. And then I would go home to my Airbnb, and I didn't know anybody. And while the people at the institute were very nice, they weren't very social. And so I spent a lot of time by myself. So I know from habit that what I needed to do was go directly from the Institute to the bike trail, and I would do 25 miles on my bike, or I would go running in a state park on a trail. And I was able to control my mood by exercise. I also paid attention to the food and ate remarkably healthy for me when I'm by myself. But I really focused on making myself do stuff. And when I was feeling down or feeling lonely, I would do some exercise. Now, I want to say flat out to the audience that, and to John, my guest, that every single thing I did was a direct consequence of reading Spark. I read Spark probably about 5 years ago, his book on exercise in the brain, and it changed the way that I looked at my life, the way that I looked at the world, the way that I looked at everything. In fact, I created a course entirely as an excuse to teach John's book, a course called Getting Fit with Aristotle. And because the book helped me just not only change my perception of everything, but also have a sense of control over my emotions and over my attitude that I, frankly, had completely abdicated. So I guess, John, the question I have for you is, first, I don't think this is an uncommon reaction to that book. Do you hear this often? And second, what is it about the book that people are reacting to? The basic premise of the book is that the exercise affects brain activity, right? That's an oversimplification. But what's so revolutionary about the book, and why does it have such a profound impact on people?
Well, yes, it does have a very big impact on people. And I, to this day, I mean, there's a new generation now. I mean, the book came out about 11 years ago, and now all of a sudden it's like it just came out for so many people. There's a new time of discovery of the book and what it means, because but to get to your question, it's a new way to say, okay, we can really change the way we feel, the way we think, the way we experience the world, and the way we are in the world with others and just in general, if you are exercising, if you're fit. And what I did in Spark was say, okay, not only, well, first what you do, you're doing is you're changing your body, and then this has a direct effect on changing your mind. You're changing your brain, making the chemicals different, making the blood flow different, all the things that exercise does. And to say, oh, I have control over this. This has been amazing for some people. There was one of the big studies that I focus on in the book was out of Duke University Medical School, where they looked at 100 people who were depressed, and they gave a third of them Zoloft, increasing doses, and a third put them on exercise regimen, and another third, they did both. Well, at the end of 4 weeks, they all became undepressed. And at the end of 4 months, that remained. At the end of 10 months, those who were exercising and stayed with it did better as a group than those on medicine. There's a lot of interest in that. But part of that is because people on medicine, when they get better, they tend to stop it. Even though they're told not to, they do. And so you see the return of the mood problems. But this was hard for people in psychiatry to deal with. But it was revolutionary for all of us to sort of see, okay, this is as good as our antidepressants, and we have control over that. So like you did at the end of your long day, you jumped up and you exercised. You changed, you know, your mind. You cleaned it out. You got rid of all the trash, if you will. And in fact, that's one of the ways we think of exercise, getting rid of the trash within ourselves. It helps then put you in a different mind state. And this is the same way with attention deficit disorder or the addictions or the anxiety problems. All that is under people's control, and we're seeing sort of this, people are getting to it. Just for instance, with the addictions, one of the things that we just had a conference of a group from around the country that are using exercise as part of the recovery process and to sustain recovery, not just to withdraw and be, you know, get over the withdrawal, but to really have this tool in their toolkit to help deal with the cravings, help avoid the temptations, avoid dropping back into their addiction path. And so, yes, in saying, okay, it's you. You're the one that has this kind of control. If you, like you did, go on your 25-mile bike ride or go out for a mile run or a couple-mile run, whatever, you have control to feel relieved, feel better, feel renewed. And that's what you did.
So for folks who haven't read the book, and everyone should read the book, just trust me, there's each of the chapters basically follows the same pattern. You pick a topic and you show how exercise helps test scores and learning, how exercise relieves stress, anxiety, depression, attention disorder, addiction, hormonal changes in women, and helps with aging. And yet it's not I don't want to appear negative to a certain kind of literature, but this isn't guru stuff, right? You're not – this isn't a new age book. You give very, very detailed and incredibly accessible accounts of the neurology, of the biochemistry, to explain why these things work and then give the scientific evidence. Now, you start off by talking about this gym class in Naperville, Illinois, I think. Yeah, Naperville, Illinois. And in the process, you say two things that are incredibly interesting to me. The first is you point out that the gym class of team sports doesn't really do much for anybody because most people in team sports are standing around doing nothing. But the other thing, in a parenthetical, you say that exercise has to be voluntary because there was a study to suggest that forced exercise amongst rats didn't have the same effect. So I guess could you talk a little bit about what a good physical education looks like and how, again, our agency and our choice relates to the benefits that are so pervasive that come from exercise?
Right. Well, you know, I think the major push to get people to want to do exercise is certainly being aware, just remembering how they felt. You know, the University of Michigan has been looking at this for the past 20 years to say, okay, what's the motivation? How do we sustain the motivation for people to exercise? And their big takeaway is think about what exercise does for you today, how much better you feel today after you've exercised. Now, and this translates into physical education kinds of things is to help, is to instruct the student that this is what you're doing and have them see how much different they feel after they've put in their time exercising or getting more fit. That day, yeah, oh, they're tired. They're, you know, that, you know, in the moment, they have to shower up and do all these things. But afterwards, they're more ready for life. They have mostly a positive look towards the immediate future. And that they are more fun to be around and are looking for things to, you know, tackle. And so their motivation is higher. And we know all kinds of stuff about how this, you know, maps onto the changes in the biochemistry or the neurochemistry of the brain. So, for instance, I always have said that a bout of exercise is like taking a little bit of Prozac and a little bit of Ritalin, because it does the same thing. And then once people see it, feel it, and then get the understanding of this, that can be a huge, and is a huge motivator for them to stay with it. Because we'll all try to sleaze our way out of it. That happens to everybody. And because we have genes that are sort of telling us to sort of store our, you know, our fuel, so we might need it tomorrow. But that's something to overcome. And what the ideal physical education class would be, partly instruction about what, why you're doing it. See, it's the why, and then the PE teachers do the what. And the why is okay, you got to find something that you like. And one of the beauties of the Naperville school system is that they're an upper middle class area, and they have enough money to offer incredible array of choices for the students to participate in when they go back to sports. But the basic of their program is getting the child's heart rate up to a training level where they're and that's how they give the grades, how much time you spend in your cardiac training zone per week.
John, can I interrupt a second?
Sure.
Because this is a really important moment. The book doesn't, as I suspect some listeners might think, doesn't say, well, we all have to have 8% body fat. We all have to become triathletes. That if you're out of shape, you're a bad person. One of the things that you highlight is that since heart rate is the measure in this physical education, people of different body types, people of different interests, people of different skill levels can all get benefit from it because the heart rate is responsive to how they are. And so it's a pass-fail class, you point out. They're not interested in, oh, we have to lose 30 pounds. It's, did you exercise today at your ideal heart rate for at least, I think, a half hour, right? That, could you talk a little bit about that, about how this is a sort of a relative measure to the person as opposed to an objective statement that we all need six-pack abs?
Right. No, it's exactly that. You know, and that was the sort of moment, paradigm shift, if you will, brought on by one of the PE teachers who recognized that even though he had his kids every day and was really a very committed PE teacher, that at the end his kids were not getting healthier. And so he's then said, okay, we have to start exercising for fitness, which is a choosy number 5 on the PE teacher's list,
right?
Where sports and movement kinds of things are emphasized first, and fitness is 5th. Well, they made it number 1, and this meant that all the kids were running and all that. But after 2 years, the same PE teacher said, hey, there's something's off here. I'm still getting my athletes the best grades. And so he said, well, I'll slap on these heart rate monitors. And so he did that, and boy, did he see a big difference. And the book starts with a bunch of kids coming in for an early PE class right before their training in reading, because they were reading to slow readers in 9th grade, and so they had a PE class right before, and they were observed as the girls were running, and 2 of them were running and talking, and the PE teacher was thinking, oh, they're just lollygagging around. Well, but afterwards he looked at their heart rates, and they were up near the maximum. So for them, they were really putting in the time, the movement, and heart rate is a measure of how much blood flow you're going to your body parts, your muscles, and all that, but also to your brain. And when it goes to your brain, that's a function of how much you're using your brain, and which is a function of how many muscles are being taxed and being used. So, and that was a big revolutionary step to say, okay, we have to grade people based on how much, where their heart rate is and whether they're pressing themselves. Because when they press themselves, that means they're growing and getting better and getting more fit. And this led to this incredible revolution that got me so excited, as later in the book I talk about how the same school system a couple of years before that had taken the TIMSS test, this International Science and Math Test, as a country, which every country takes every 3 years. And last year, 2 years ago, the U.S. came in 19th and 20th, which is about where we always are. But the Naperville school system, 99% of the kids took it, and they came in number one in the world in science and number six in math. So not only were they among the fittest kids in the U.S., but they were among the smartest or the best performing, I should say. Because there's other school systems that are really good that take this test and do not score near as high as the kids from Naperville. So this is what got me on an airplane to get to Naperville and find out what the heck was going on. And it was amazing because the PE teachers were like mini neuroscientists. I couldn't send them enough papers. I couldn't give them enough information about how this was affecting the kids' brain. They were so excited, and they passed it on to their students, and it just it caught fire. And it continues to this day, and the PE teachers are seen as being very relevant in the child's life in school and their school performance.
So you said something in passing, which I'm thinking about while you're talking, which is, and this is the kind of thing that seems so obvious once someone says it, but it never occurred to me. You said because the heart rate is a measure of blood flow to the brain, it's also an indication of how much you're using your brain, right? And that challenges the dichotomy right there between exercise and intellect. You were pointing out that, right, exercise makes kids smarter, not dumber. Makes it easier to learn. You talk in the book about how two of the graduates from this school, right before they would take the tests, if they get nervous or if they needed an extra boost, they would go swim in a pool or run and do staircase work. Right, running up and down the staircase, that would improve. And then also in the book, you talk about how because this isn't team sports, it's not competitive. And you tell the story of a young woman who isn't quite as fit as everyone else, who is trying to do a rock climb and is stuck in the middle, and how she gets support from everyone else, right? Exercise becomes a bonding activity rather than a competitive activity. How important is that aspect? How important is the social aspect of bonding? And to sort of anticipate our discussion of your next book, the tribalism, the collectivity of the human exercise and just the human experience as a whole?
It's a major league benefit of exercise, is to be exercising with a group. You know, people always want to know, well, what's the best exercise to do? And the easy answer is to exercise outside with someone and something that you both enjoy and will come back to and feel responsible to each other to come back for it. So this is why you see this explosion of interest in group exercise, in the bike clubs, in triathlon training groups, in running groups, in walking groups, in Zumba, in yoga, and the big one is CrossFit. and now Orange Theory. These are exploding with membership and new campuses sort of coming up all over the place. And CrossFit I know very well, and it is amazing what happens. And it's where you're together and you're cheering each other on and you're promoting one another to do more than you did last time. But there's a bonding there, a social bonding across socioeconomic barriers. I mean, it's amazing. You know, the carpenter will become friends with the university professor. And someone driving a bus will be friends with an entrepreneur in the CrossFit class because they're, you know, working together. And the story that you mentioned from the book was, it sent a chill through me just remembering it, because this was a girl who was not very good this was in junior high, so she was just getting into being fit. And she was having a struggle with climbing the wall. And all the kids below started to cheer for her. And she came back down and she said, that's the first time anybody's cheered for me ever. And she remembered that, and it was so poignant. Me as a psychiatrist, you know, and just as a human being, was, you know, overcome with emotion. Because it really meant something to her. And so, and that's what you see with all kinds of sport, but certainly the kind that, where you get kids that are not very good in sport and athletics, but then do something and then everybody cheers them on. Became a problem for me with CrossFit, because I would be cheered on by my mates and try to do more than I should and end up in the orthopod's office a little too often. So, you know, just you go beyond yourself, but it's wonderful at the same time. So you have to always measure and balance what you're doing with what you can do.
So one of the things that you do when you shift from Spark to Go Wild is you take a much wider point of view. Spark is focused on the connection between exercise and neurological activity and the positive effects. And then in Go Wild, you look at the history of humanity and prehistory and sort of get some recommendations and get some guidance from the way human beings used to be. And one of the pivotal moments in the book is that you suggest that these words that we use, the word disease that we use to describe hypertension and anxiety and depression, might better be thought of as injuries, and injuries from civilization and illness from civilization. I wonder if you talk a little bit about that, in part because it will lead to a question that one of our listeners had in advance. But what do you mean by an injury from civilization, and how does that long view help us understand better both what's happening in Spark, but what's happening in a lot of other areas of research as well?
Yeah, no, it a lot of our diseases are diseases of civilization that we have, that we're not following the dictates of the way we evolved. One of the things about exercise is that our big brains evolved to be the best movers that we could be. And then we added more brain stuff on in our frontal cortex, in our cerebellum. And then these areas of the brain were taken over when we began to talk and have larger social groups. They were taken over to think with. And this is what people don't recognize, that when you're activating those nerve cells, you're not only activating the moving brain cells, but the thinking brain cells. And then we activate these cells, that makes them stronger and better. And so, and the same thing with not using them or not following the dictates of what we, how we evolved. We have problems then with blood pressure, with handling the sugar, handling, well, having too much sugar is another evolutionary problem that we have, but handling our diet. And today we have this big sleep deprivation problem across the world because of our cell phones and other toys that we have that keep us awake. And we're not paying attention to who we are and where we are in the world. And we're, you know, the big thing today is loneliness. So we're, and all these things impact our mental health, certainly, but our physical health as well. So that leads to the injuries of civilization, or the injuries of not paying attention to who we are. And because, you know, heart disease is a relatively recent thing, a recent problem. Certainly ADHD is, and many of our psychiatric problems didn't happen before. Of course, we lived a lot less long, but we didn't have those kinds of illnesses that we now are beset with. For instance, the big one that's really changed in my lifetime, when I was in medical school, it was sort of rare to see someone with diabetes type 2. As a medical student, if we saw one in clinic, we wanted to have one to follow, because we didn't have those. It wasn't common at all. And now you go into pharmacy and you see all this whole line of products being sold at the back of the store for diabetes, maintaining the sugar, you know, whatever, just all kinds of things. That, and because it's just such an epidemic, secondary to our poor diets and poor exercise habits and poor sleep habits, all of which lead to a disease, if you will, of civilization, or an injury of, you know, we have the capacity to not do, to not move, to not, you know, to go after the highest caloric food we can find, which in the, you know, as we evolved, that was something we evolved with. We evolved with these thrifty genes to help us, you know, forestall the problem we would have when we couldn't find food, and when we had to search for it and go for it, that we wanted to have fat on us so that we could use it, break it down and use it. And so we have that tendency. And so this is a huge disease of civilization that you see every day, and you hear about it all the time. And you have so many commercials on about the appropriate products to use now to help overcome it, lower your A1C, you know, get rid of unwanted fat, or, you know, manage your glucose better. All those things are really new and happening, and it's even within our lifetime seeing this change.
I want to ask a question that came from one of our long-term listeners, Ashley, and I know that she sent it sort of cynically, crassly. I don't know that she expected me to take it seriously, but I want to ask it, and I'll ask it in her phrasing first, and then I'll sort of explain why I think it's an important question. She said, when I sent the announcement that you were going to be on the guest, she said, so you're going to ask about how white dudes are understanding and fixing what white dudes ruined when they took power away from women thousands of years ago? And I want to ask that question in part because I like to take all of our listeners seriously, but also, to what extent are the diseases of civilization the products of particular social and political orders, the product of gender debates and imperialism and all that? And to what extent is this really about, on the evolutionary scale, civilization, period, whatever form it takes? One of the points that you make is that human beings haven't evolved in the last 40 to 50,000 years, and so the bodies that we have now are the bodies that we had before civilization. So Ashley's question, would it be better under a different social and political organization, or is this just the consequence of no longer being hunter-gatherers?
Well, I think we could have found a better way to accommodate ourselves to the growth of civilization. I think the issue is that the civilizations evolve so fast. Moore's law, you know, I mean, all the ways that our computer and digital world has sort of overtaken anything in terms of the speed of change. It's just amazing. And now we're hitting artificial intelligence, and oh my God, we are all in for a huge shock. But is there an ideal form? Is there the ideal kind of place or kind of system that we could have evolved into to avoid these problems? Well, I'm sure a lot of it would have been respecting our ancient wisdom and respecting the indigenous people more and their attachment to the earth and their valuing it, which today we've not valued it. We are destroying it. But that's just one part of it. But also valuing each other, valuing the family, which in many areas of the world now we're coming back to doing that. But it's still a huge problem throughout the world. And the shift to following those that have, or to have more of what? More toys and then you win? No. You know, I mean, it's like we're pressing ourselves to get stuff that we're told we need to have, and we obviously don't need to have them. But yet we are on that train to get them, and that leads to a lot of strife and disappointment and unnecessary anxiety, depression, and all the slings and arrows of our mental life that we can find.
In Spark, you mention a study in which a cat which only had use of one eye, comparing cats with two eyes and one eye, and the cat having one eye artificially shut, would shrink their brain. And you make the connection between that and low-income kids who don't have the same opportunities and the effect it would have on their neurology. Is oppression, and I think this is part of what Ashley is getting at too, does oppression and marginalization affect the brain negatively? And can the studies that you're citing, either in Spark or in Go Wild, help mitigate that negativity?
Oh, absolutely. Oppression, and trauma just really, really affect the brain in a very negative way. And it takes more than a village to undo a lot of that or to help correct that for the terrors or for just the dullness and for the lack of motivation, for the lack of seeing the future. in a way that people that have the advantages do see the future, do see what's possible, do are aware of these things. And all of us can think of our own lives that way too. You know, when people that had more advantages, they traveled more, they knew about things that we didn't know about earlier in their life, and that led to all kinds of different choices for them and possibilities and range of activities. And so when you're talking about the oppressed, and Ashley's talking about the oppression of minorities and the feminine, I mean, yeah, that has an effect on the brain, making the brain work less well. And when you start off with that early on, it's then harder to overcome and harder to get your brain to the same level that it might have been. So absolutely. And I don't know if it's white dudes who did it all, but that seems to, that's the a almost right on punching bag these days. But it is just, you know, the strong survived, and that's what happened. And then, you know, there are a few lucky breaks, and civilization in one area beat the civilization in another, and so forth and so on. And we then are left with this incredible, huge disparity in standard of living, etc. And that's a huge problem in our world, and we know it. And as you know, the studies about kids having books around, you know, and like my grandkids could open up their own, you know, child library for right. people, because we have three sets of grandparents and two maiden aunts, and so forget it, you know. But think about the same age kids that don't have any books around, you know, just TV and the Game Boy or the internet. You know, it's a big difference. And books relate to how much they're read to, how much they care about reading, how much they care about story. All that is, you know, something that is reflective of this their standard of living. Their parents, you know, they're able to do these things. They're able to go to the zoo. They're able to go to the children's museum or the aquarium. People from lower incomes aren't going to be doing that, and the kids don't have any idea what a octopus really looks like, you know. And so it's these are things that absolutely are important for ideal brain development, to get it, you know, being aware of all the different possibilities, all the different areas of the world even.
I want to ask one more question from a listener, because I think it's a really important one. And then I have one more question. I know you are on a limited schedule, but we got a question from Jackie from Bismarck, who's also a longtime listener, and she has been struggling for the last few years with autoimmune encephalitis. And she's curious about two different things. One, which is tangential to the conversation, which is the relationship between memory and intelligence. But I think she's also interested in, sort of on her behalf, given what she wrote, to what extent can the recommendations in Spark, can the observations in Go Wild help heal with a brain injury? To what extent, I know that there's a certain sense, because I know Jackie personally, that people want to treat her very fragilely and very carefully, and there's of course great insecurity about her illness. To what extent do you think your research shows that someone with a brain injury and someone with an illness like autoimmune encephalitis can counter the effects of the diseases with exercise and with lifestyle choices. You've talked quite a bit in Spark especially, but also in Go Wild about exercise effect on cancer and other such things. But this is a brain injury. Is it a different class? Is it a different circumstance?
No, I think that's a problem. Now, I'm not sure about the autoimmune encephalitis, but one of the things we do know about living right, and by that I mean being well and in a wellness lifestyle, is that with exercise, with the appropriate diet, with sleep, with connection, which is so important in any healing and especially the brain, these all help to do a lot to change the present and the future of the person's illness, because it helps hugely with neuroinflammation. I mentioned earlier that the lifestyle and the wellness prescription for the anti-Alzheimer people and the anti-depression people holds, because a big part of what they're looking at is reducing inflammation in the brain. That this is the major cause of brain erosion. And also, just this morning, getting a review from the literature on the benefits of exercise on cancer. What does it do? The big benefit is it's boosting the immune system. Now, that's not necessary. I mean, autoimmune system, too, is something that can be affected positively by exercise to get the sort of right kind of immune things happening. And so I would say she should really look into that and see, but not to be so timid and to really go after it. I mean, and that's what we see with concussion, post-concussive syndrome, which is a huge thing these days, right? It was, we just have to let them rest for a while, and stroke, the same thing. You let them rest for a little bit, meaning a few days, and then you push them. You have them do stuff. You have them move, try to move their stroke.limb, or try to get back to exercising, maybe slower than they would have been before the concussion, but nonetheless to keep them and get them moving, because when you're moving, you're making all these factors that help repair and recovery, and that's what you want. And the same thing would hold for someone, I'm sure, with encephalitis, although one has to really also follow the literature as to what's been done. I know certainly for MS, for Parkinson's, for these brain problems that are slow in developing, the best thing you can be doing is exercising. And then along with that, of living right, of living a wellness in the midst of wellness, by having enough connections, by being present, and the best help to be mindful is mindfulness training, which is meditation, yoga, tai chi. Those things are really crucial to keeping our brains the wellest they can be.
What you just said about concussions really speaks to me. We have a family friend in the neighborhood. She's now in college, but in high school she had two concussions in the same soccer game, and it really knocked her for a loop, so to speak. And she went to school, but she was on a lot of bed rest for a year, year and a half, and it took incredibly long time to heal. And insofar as I know the details, there was no push towards exercise at all. And this idea that it helps reduce inflammation, which again is a huge topic right now in medical literature, I'm excited and shocked, and I want to go tell the family what you just said. And that leads to my last question, which is something you say early on, very early on in Go Wild, which is that lifestyle choice affects the DNA, and that we tended to think, we used to think of the DNA as an immutable code, but in fact, it can be altered, and it can be altered by lifestyle choice, by exercise, and by other such things. So sort of as a concluding comment, what don't we understand about the brain that we should? One of the things you say in Spark is that despite what people say, we do, parts of our brains do grow back. So what, how did we in general misunderstand how the brain works? And how does that extend to that comment about DNA? What's the fundamental paradigm shift that you want our listeners to make that you are articulating and exploring in your actually three books, not just the two books?
Yes. What everyone should know is that, yes, we can affect our DNA by all the things that we do and all the situations we're in. And wellness is the best way to affect the DNA. There's something that we call epigenetics, meaning you have your genes, you have your DNA prescription, but you activate this gene or that gene depending on what environment, what activity, what you're doing, what you're eating, how much you're sleeping, how much you're exercising. All that affects your DNA, which then affects the amount of protein you make and all that kind of stuff. And it goes on and on, down to having enough neurotransmitter that then will lead to all kinds of different ways of seeing or feeling about the world. So what people should know is that if you're living right, and by that I mean getting enough sleep, getting certainly being involved with others, which we call vitamin C for vitamin connect, exercising, being present, getting into nature, which we just touched on, but that's a huge component of wellness that we so often miss, because we're biophiliacs. We're in love with nature, and we need to be in nature because it has so many powerful benefits for us. But because that they change the DNA's expression. That is how many proteins we're making or not making, depending on what our lifestyle is and what we do to ourselves and to others. And that helps change our brain right now, for the present, acutely, and make long-term chronic changes. So I think people thought, you get your brain, you get your body, and that's it. But we know that certainly from your body side, you know that if you exercise your muscles, you will grow them or at least not lose them. And the same way goes for the brain. The more you use it, the better it gets. And when I talk about anti-aging paradigms, the first thing I say is we want to have enough challenge in our lives, because challenge leads to momentary stresses, which is the beginning of growth. If we don't challenge our bodies or our brains, we're not going to have them grow. And when we do challenge them, it helps our bodies and our brains grow in a way that we are guiding it.
As we close, I just want to say to you, to our audience, that all I can really say in response is that given what I learned from Spark and my experiences in my day-to-day life, everything that you say, John, is bared out, not just in my weekly experience, but in my moment-to-moment. I can feel the difference in my life, and I can feel happier because of the prescriptions that you offer. So thank you for the books. Thank you for the research. And thank you so much for joining us on Why. As you know, I've been chasing you for a little while, and I'm super excited to have you. And it has just been a pleasure and a wonderful experience for me. And I hope you enjoyed it as well.
I have, and it's a pleasure shared. So I enjoyed your questions. I enjoyed talking to another philosopher, and enjoyed sort of going through a circuitous path to the issues and my work. So I appreciate being with you, and had a ton of positive feeling.
You have been listening to Why, Philosophical Discussion About Everyday Life with John Rady and Jack Russell Weinstein. I will be back with just a few more thoughts right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We were talking to John Rady about wellness, about the relationship between exercise and the brain, and the diseases of civilization and how we can change our fate, so to speak. There were a lot of details we didn't get into, in part because we don't have the time of a book, but in part because we were looking at the larger philosophical questions. The books, Spark and Go Wild, tell very specific, very particular ideas as to how to achieve these results, how to use exercise to heal, how to think about food and social life and anxiety and stress and all of those things. And as I said, I have used a lot of these prescriptions, and I am significantly better off because of it. I started doing triathlons last year, and in my head, a triathlon is a pill. A triathlon is a substitute for medication. And if medication works for you, that's great, but this can supplement and sometimes even replace. But there is a bigger philosophical point here, and it goes back to my initial comments in the monologue. I described the mind-body duality and talked about the Christian tradition where the body is the source of negativity and the mind is the source of positivity. But there's another aspect of that tradition that comes through, and that is we have this idea that because of the fall, we are degenerating. Because we are no longer in paradise, we are becoming worse as a species and as individuals. And one of the most exciting thing about John's work is that it turns this on its head, at least in terms of the individual life. We are not doomed by what we are given and then living a life in which we get worse and worse and worse and worse until we die. We are given the opportunity to improve, to become better, to heal the machine, to fix that which is broken. And yes, there are limitations. We have two arms. Some of us have one. Some of us have none. That's going to affect how we exercise. Some of us have illnesses. That's going to affect how we choose our lifestyles. We can't fix or do everything, and no human being can ever be perfect. But what John's research shows us is that we do have agency, and we do have the ability to improve, and we do have some control where traditionally we thought we have none. That is super exciting. The fact that there is scientific evidence, the most advanced neurological research using CAT scans and PET scans and all other kinds of scans that I don't know exist, right? Peer-reviewed studies to show that all of this stuff is true and it works. So if you walk away from this episode with one message other than John's description of how the brain works as we ended the discussion, walk away with this. You have the control to make your life better, happier, more fulfilling, because we are evolutionarily designed to improve ourselves, And physical improvement is just as important as mental improvement. Mental improvement is vital to physical improvement. They go hand in hand. They're both sides of the same coin. They're both versions of the same thing. You've been listening to Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. Thank you for listening. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.